He began his life with all the classic handicaps and disadvantages. His mother was a powerfully built, dominating woman who found it difficult to love anyone. She had been married 3 times, and her second husband divorced her because she beat him up regularly. The father of the child I'm describing was her third husband. He died of a heart attack a few months before the child's birth. As a consequence, the mother had to work long hours from his earliest childhood. She gave him no affection, no love, no discipline, and no training during those early years. She even forbade him to call her at work. Other children had little to do with him. He was alone most of his life. He was absolutely rejected from his earliest childhood. He was ugly and poor and untrained and unlovable. When he was 13 years old, a school psychologist commented that he probably didn't even know the meaning of the word love. During adolescence, the girls would have nothing to do with him, and he fought with the boys often. Despite a high IQ, he failed academically and finally dropped out during his 3rd year in high school. They reportedly built men in the Marine Corps, and so he thought he would find a new acceptance there, and he wanted to be one, so when he went, unfortunately, his problems went with him. The other Marines laughed at him and ridiculed him. He fought back, resisted authority, and was court-martialed, thrown out of the Marines with an undesirable discharge. So there he was, a young man in his early 20s, absolutely friendless and shipwrecked. He was small and scrawny in stature. He had an adolescent squeak in his voice. He was balding early in life. He had no talent, no skill, no sense of worthiness. He didn't even have a driver's license. Once again, he thought he could run from his problems, so he went to a foreign country to live. But he was rejected there too. Nothing had changed. While there, he married a girl who herself had been an illegitimate child and brought her back to America with him. Soon she began to develop the same contempt for him that everyone else had displayed. She bore him 2 children, but he never enjoyed the status and respect that a father and husband should have. His marriage continued to crumble. His wife demanded more and more things that he could not provide. Instead of being his ally against the bitter world, as he had hoped, she became his most vicious opponent. She could outfight him. She learned to bully him. On one occasion, she locked him in the bathroom as punishment. Finally, she forced him to leave. He tried to make it on his own, but was terribly lonely. After days of solitude, he went home, literally begging her to take him back. He surrendered all pride. He crawled. He cried. He accepted humiliation. He came on her terms. Despite his meager salary, he brought her $78 as a gift, asking her to take it and spend it any way she wished, but she laughed at him. She belittled his feeble attempts to supply the family's needs. She ridiculed his failure. She made fun of his sexual impotency in front of a friend who was there. At one point, he fell on his knees and wept aloud as the greater darkness of his private nightmare enveloped him. Finally, in silence, he pleaded no more. No one wanted him. No one had ever wanted him. He was perhaps the most rejected man of our time. His ego lay shattered in a fragmented dust. The next day, he was strangely a different man. He arose, went to the garage, took down a rifle he had hidden there, carried it with him to his newly acquired job at a book storage building in Dallas. And from a window on the 3rd floor of that building, shortly after noon, November 22, 1963, he sent 2 shells crashing into the head of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Lee Harvey Oswald, the rejected, unlovable failure, killed the man who, more than any other single individual on earth, embodied all the success, beauty, wealth, and family affection which he lacked. In firing that rifle, he utilized the one skill he had learned in his entire miserable lifetime. Such is the tragic pilgrimage of a loser. A man no one wants to emulate. But I'm convinced such are the same feelings of many who anticipate a life of ministry. Isn't it easy to be here 4 years and to watch paraded in front of you one, quote, successful person after another as you sit riveted to your chair, dreading the day you have to be some kind of success? Not that there's anything wrong with success, we know that, but there's something strangely mysterious about being able to get a handle on how do I do that? And how do I get over the feelings that overwhelm me? Our 17-year-old son played football in high school, and he, after his senior year on the team, he said often that there were teams that just blew them away, the way he put it. And he said, "Dad, there are feelings like that I get at other times." And I said to him, "Son, I understand. I've got those same feelings." The feeling of being blown away, out of touch, and really ineffective because of it. Right? And you know that you cannot find the security that you've cultivated here. You know out there they are real and live, and some of them are savage, and they bite back, and they don't understand the Hebrew, and they don't get impressed with the nuance of some theological point that just, you know, keeps you up late in ecstasy. So throughout this week, I want to talk about those feelings of inadequacy. And I want to do some confessing and some admitting, and I want to do some modeling verbally as well as textually of the whole issue of the ministry and me, and how I can piece it together so as to step into some phase, whether it be a small or larger work, multiple or single staff, camping or expositional ministry, whatever, without some kind of anchor that drives me in my solitude to despair. And I'll tell you guys, there are more men than ever in these years I've been in ministry that are leaving it for just such reasons. The inability to get a handle on it and to feel confident in what they are doing and feel fulfilled because of the constant battle of comparison. And so I want to turn to the life of a man named Moses in Exodus chapters 2, 3, and 4, as well as in Acts chapter 7. And when you name Moses, he seems like the last person you'd ever admit. He wasn't a loser. He could swim at the age of 3 months. He was raised in Egypt in a palace. He had the best of education. Josephus tells us he was already astute as a military leader before the age of 30. He was a competent, capable scholar, as we will read in Acts. He was mighty in words and in deeds. Don't kid me, Swindoll. That guy was not inadequate. Yeah, he was. And I want us to begin with today to see why, and to see how all of that kind of crashed in on him, and how even the one that has all of those gifts and can be so much the model can flake out when it comes down to the final test, and that is ministry God's way. Well, you know the story of his birth. It's remarkable. First part of chapter 2 of Exodus. His roots go way back to Egypt. And his mother's name was Jochebed. His dad's name was Amram. And in a little humble hut, he was born under the duress of an Egyptian threat. The Pharaoh at that time had a bad time with Jewish boys and made it clear that they were not to live. And God marvelously preserved him through this encounter with the mother and the daughter of Pharaoh. And finally, little Moses was taken by the woman. And verse 10 of chapter 2 says, he grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, that is the mother, after weaning him, after investing a few years in his life, she released him to Pharaoh's court, to Pharaoh's daughter. Well, if you've got a son, probably he's young because you are young, and you can feel the emotion already of a mother who deposits for adoption her son that she loves just that he might survive. And knowing that survival in the Egyptian court might be the demise of any religious sense, any accountability to Jehovah. But she releases him. And it says that the woman took the child and he became her son. He became her son. She renamed him Moses because I drew him out of the water. New name, great plans. Josephus says she designed Moses for the throne as Pharaoh had no son. So there started in process, in motion, the whole preparation for an effective role of leadership. Perhaps it's true, Pharaoh in the making. And he had all it took. He had the necessary mental acumen to handle the disciplines of the school. Now it's time to leave Exodus and look into Acts chapter 7, verse 21. You sort of have to compare the two, as you know, from place to place so that you can kind of keep a running narrative on his life. What Moses himself does not mention, Stephen does in his account, Acts 7. Okay, Moses is going to undergo an entire cultural renovation. His roots are in Jewish blood, but his life is in Egypt, and now he is to imbibe at the trough, at the fountain of Egypt's schooling. We read in 21, after he had been exposed, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. Significant term, means to nourish, to educate, to rear. So she took the boy and she decided that she would frame him into the Pharaoh elect. And in the process of remaking him, he had to learn the protocol, the lifestyle, and of course had to be schooled in the Oxford of the ancient world. Edersheim says this about that ancient school. It was a place where they mastered the mysterious hieroglyphics, various sciences, mathematics, astronomy, chemistry, medicine, theology, philosophy, and a knowledge of law formed the courses. The arts were not overlooked. There was music, sculpturing, painting, a broad knowledge of Egyptian literature. There were no football scholarships. There was no basket weaving major. There was just strain, plain old hard study. And the guy took it in. And the verse says, verse 22, he was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians. He got it all together and he was bright. And he, I'm sure, graduated with honors. He must have been a strange case. This Jewish appearance surrounded by the dark-skinned Egyptians, and he must have been sort of a unique guy to watch as he kept coming out on top. Sharp, with it, competent, capable, just like some of you. And from all the externals, it looked like everything would be a downhill slide. He was distinguished in word and deed. Verse 22, he was a man of power in words and deeds. By his mid-30s, he was a commander in the Egyptian army. He had already distinguished himself in a battle over the Ethiopians. He's got it. He's got clout. Powerful. Impressive. And then came the first blow to his confidence. That comes shortly after schooling. Moses, I don't think Moses heard God's call the first time at the burning bush. I think, though it is not written in the text, from the way the verses read in Acts 7 and in Exodus chapter 2 and in Exodus chapter 3, I get it that he had a sense of mission before the bush. And the bush was an affirmation of what God had already said. And sensing that he was to be some kind of deliverer, some kind of guide for this exodus, this deliverance project, he decided to roll up his sleeves and handle it himself. All right? Verse 23. He wasn't young. He was age 40. It entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel, and when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance on for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. Okay, back to the ranch. Exodus chapter 2. Here's the other part of it. You start to get the shading over here. Exodus 2, verse 11. It came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that. He did not look up. You'll note, when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. That's what you do when you operate in the flesh. If you're going to deliver Israel, you got to start by killing the Egyptians. And that's number one. So he strikes him down, and he also strikes out because he can't even cover up his work of the flesh. You never can. You never can. It'll haunt you. It'll come back to meet you. It'll visit you at night, in the quiet hours. It'll even visit you when all sorts of accolades are brought upon you. You will know the truth. I think it's Clarence McCartney who says, every step up to the pulpit to preach will be haunted in the life of a pastor whose life is impure. And Moses, I am convinced in the strength and zeal of the flesh drove this Egyptian out of life under the sand and began to think, how now can I continue this process of deliverance? So the next day, he works on plan B. Verse 13, when he went out, two Hebrews were fighting with each other, and he said to the offender, why are you striking your companion? He said, who made you a prince or a judge over us? You intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? The secret is out. You going to kill me too? And Moses, now watch verse 14. For the first time, this competent, capable, scholarly, bright guy is afraid. Moses was afraid and said, the matter has become known. In the life of an effective, growing ministry, you will be tempted to substitute, to fake it, and it will not stay hidden. It will come to the surface. It'll be there. It'll be found out. And this man, found out, becomes afraid. You see, he tried to cover it up. That is so common. Instead of facing the truth of what happened and saying, you're right, I'm guilty, I've murdered him, it was wrong, he covered it up. I got a chuckle out of some accident report forms that were published in the Toronto Sun. Maybe you read some of them. People, these are actual accidental reports. I thought my window was down, but I found out it was up when I put my hand through it, was one. A truck backed through my windshield into my wife's face is another one. The pedestrian hit me and went under my car. The guy was all over the road. I had to swerve a number of times before I hit him. I pulled away from the side of the road, glanced at my mother-in-law, and headed over the embankment. An invisible car came out of nowhere and struck my vehicle and vanished. The pedestrian had no idea which direction to go, so I ran over him. I saw the slow-moving, sad-faced old gentleman as he bounced off the hood of my car. The telephone pole was approaching fast. I attempted to swerve out of its path when it struck my front end. I was on my way to the doctor's with rear end trouble when my universal joint gave way, causing me to have an accident. Guy's got trouble. Just face it. Just face it. Just tell the truth. That's all. And in the tremendous attempt to cover up and to keep the ego intact, we lie, or we make it another story, or we hedge on it. And oh, can the preacher hedge? Thinking that you will lose if you tell the truth. Ah, you will gain. Moses hid him in the sand, and then when discovered, then it was compounded by fear. And this incredible sense of fear stretched over him. And he knew he was done for. He knew it was curtains. I want you to look at this guy who has become our model of leadership with all of the preparations for 40 years. And I want you to find him in verse 15. When Pharaoh heard of the matter, he tried to kill Moses. I can't believe that. Here is a man who has been all of these things, Pharaoh's elect, Pharaoh's choice, and now Pharaoh tries to kill him. It can happen just like that. Guillermo Vilas, who is a very, very well-known tennis player down in Argentina, says, and you'd think it's security personified, fervently, I think that many times one feels oneself to be secure, and suddenly one's world falls down like a pack of cards in a matter of seconds. Happened to me the first time I endured an earthquake in California. Well, you can't imagine that feeling. I said to my wife, 6 o'clock in the morning, "What's that?" Which was a brilliant question, of course. And she said, "That's an earthquake." The house behind us has a pool, and the water was going, whew, whew. And I was going, All four kids came running in screaming, you know. And the chandelier was going like this. And I was thinking, where do you jump? Where do you go? All of a sudden, the world came in. And all of a sudden, in Moses' life, he's running. And he does not know what to do. Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. There's our man. Alan Redpath has said, when God wants to do an impossible task, he takes an impossible man and crushes him. He's being crushed. You see, Moses wanted to do God's will, but he wanted to do it his way. He knew that deliverance was necessary. He knew that slavery was wrong. He knew that his people deserved better. He knew the promise that Abraham had been given. He knew there had to be some way out. And he said, "I'll do it. I'm the man. Jewish blood, Egyptian culture. Why not?" Why not? Because it wasn't God's way. And so he's licking his wounds by the well in the Midian desert. I was given a book by my sister some time ago called God's Wilderness. It's a beautiful, beautiful, large display, pictorial display of I think, almost a $100 book of the wilderness of Sinai. You know, and having never been there, I had the vision that it was just some kind of fabulous spot. Man, it is wall-to-wall gravel. You know? In fact, in the book it says, the southern Negev is a bare, unending gravel plain with never a glimpse of water or vegetation. That's where he sat down. The guy that had enjoyed the Nile and all its luxury and all its foliage, I'll tell you, he is facing reality. And it happens, men. It happens today. It happens at the most unbelievable moment. The world comes in on you. I had ministered in Florida and then unfortunately had added to that long trip a stop off at Wichita on the way back, and I got off the plane and the wind was blowing. The wind is always blowing in Wichita. And I got to my hotel room, which was seemed like the 4,000th floor in this hotel, and the window wouldn't close, and it was coming in the wind, and I kept looking for the booger man to come in there on me at that moment. It was just really cold, and it was really lonely, and so before I unpacked, I picked up the phone, called home, and I dialed her number, and I got Cynthia, and she said, maybe you better sit down. Don't tell me to sit down. That's bad stuff when I hear to sit down. Said, just got back from the doctor's. And he doesn't like what he sees in one of the breasts. In fact, he wants to do surgery right now. I was facing 6 speaking assignments in 2 days. I was tired from the Florida deal. And here I was having to deal with this crushing news. Now that is reality. That is where it's at. That is bottom line ministry. And I'll tell you, I really cried. And over a number of 100 miles over the phone, we sort of tried to piece it back together. She comes from a history of cancer. Mother died of it. Grandmother died of it. Grandfather died of it. And I could just see all this pass in review, and I sat down there by the well in the land of Midian. I'm happy to say that it worked out great. It was benign, but I needed about those 4 days to just face the possibility of loss. And I'll testify to you today that I never have known in a time of ministry, in a place like that, such freedom and release and such dependence on God. Those are essential times. To come to an absolute end of all the strength that you have and all of your ability, and to find yourself forced wall to wall, nose to nose with reality, and to say, I can't do it. Now I have to do it. And so I just kind of walked with him as he did it. It's marvelous. Moses sat down, highly qualified to be completely useless. How's that for a theme? For the graduating class, huh? Hey, don't kid me. It is frightening when you think of having to slip away, step into a scene that's uncertain, answer to a board of men that at night are vampires. That's not true now. You guys, don't go out and tell him that. And you know the uncertainty of your future. You know you haven't anything you can promise for sure to your wife. You do not know what the future holds. You've gotten all of this training and you walk out with 4 bags full of books wondering, who in the world wants me? And then you're there, and the first few months, you suddenly realize they don't want a professor. They want a shepherd. And I've never been one. Inadequacy. We'll work through how Moses worked through it later, but before we close, listen. Jim Dobson, my good friend. Boy, I really love Jim, and the things that he and Shirley have been through would make another story. Writes this. I was invited recently to conduct a lecture series for faculty and students at a seminary. It seemed appropriate that I talk to these future ministers about the subject of inferiority, since they would be soon dealing with many such problems in their congregations. During the course of my first address, I relayed a story of a man I called Danny. Danny was a distressed high school student whose grief over his inadequacy became intolerable and eventually turned to anger. After I had spoken that day, I received the following anonymous letter. Dear Dr. Dobson, I'm one of the Dannys you spoke of in chapel today. I've experienced inadequacy as long as I can remember. It is a miserable way to live. Yes, I'm a student at the seminary, but that doesn't make the problem any less acute. Through the years, particularly the last five, I have periodically gained a revived hope that somehow the problem might dissolve or go away. Then, to my great disappointment, I find it is still very much a part of me. That's when I lose hope of ever conquering it. And then he goes on and signs, sincerely, a troubled seminarian. Since this broken young man had not identified himself publicly, I read and discussed the letter with the student body the following morning. Many of the 300 students were present. Seemed moved by the words. For some, undoubtedly, it reflected their own predicament. Following my lecture that morning, this troubled seminarian came and introduced himself to me. He stood with tears streaming down his cheeks as he spoke of the great sense of inadequacy, fear, inferiority. Later, an administrator of the seminary told me that this man was the last member of the student body they would have ever expected to feel that way. As I have observed so many times, this sense of inferiority is the best-kept secret of the year. Sitting in the audience the same day was another student with the same kind of problems. However, he did not write me a letter. He never identified himself in any way. But 3 weeks after I left, he hanged himself in the basement of his apartment. One of the four men with whom he lived called long distance to inform me of the tragedy. He stated, deeply shaken, that the dead student's roommates were so unaware of his problems that he hanged there 5 days before he was missed. Let's bow together. The only comfort we have, our Father, in a threatening arena of uncertainty and insecurity is the fact that you are the foundation, the rock. And I would pray today as you minister in a special way regarding this whole issue of being highly qualified and yet feeling so desperately inadequate, that you would say some things through your man, Moses, and your word, so as to give encouragement and hope to some who, if the truth were known, have even considered taking their own lives. I pray for a renewed sense of direction, for relief from the perfection standard, especially from the unrealistic expectations that lead to idealism and a false sense of dedication. In the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord, amen.